Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about the fall of the Roman Republic, a fascinating story which may, especially if you're following the news today, could be quite interesting to look back and try to find some of those parallels. Joining me here in the studio is Mike Duncan. Now, Mike Duncan is a renowned history podcaster. He hosted the award-winning History of Rome podcast, and he is now currently producing another popular podcast, which is called Revolutions, and it is a series of podcasts about major historic revolutions in history. He is the author of the new book, The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. Mike Duncan, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to the station.
Thank you for having me.
This is a conversation I'm very much looking forward to have. It's a fascinating one. And let's first talk about the period we are talking about. When we say the fall of the Roman Republic, probably important to note, the fall of the Roman Republic is quite different than the fall of the Roman Empire.
The fall of the Roman Republic is very different from the fall of the Roman Empire, and I thank you for getting it right, because it is something that you run into where you're like, oh, you're talking about the fall of the Roman Empire. And it's like, no, the fall of the Roman Empire happens, around about 500 AD. You know, the period of my book is 146 BC, so I mean, it's 650 years earlier. That's quite a stretch of time difference there. And, you know, Julius Caesar is operating when the Republic does finally fall. You know, the storm that is, my book is The Storm Before the Storm. The actual storm that I'm obviously referring to is, you know, when Caesar comes along and Pompey and Octavian and Mark Antony, that's all in the 30s and 40s BC. So when it's a changeover, it's a massive transition that Roman civilization goes through, where for 500 years they had been governed by this, you know, a cooperative government, shared leadership, shared responsibilities. You know, one man could not be consul for more than a year. There were always two consuls every year. There were popular assemblies. There was voting. There was a lot of participatory aspects to their government, which collapsed in a series of gigantic civil wars that that everybody, you know, has some understanding of, just because, you know, Julius Caesar is all wrapped up in this and he's a pretty well-known historical figure. Well, once the Republic collapses, the empire does go on for 500 more years. Yes. And Roman civilization continues to flourish. It's just what was lost was all of those participatory aspects, where it's now the government of Rome is an autocratic military dictatorship. I mean, there's no real other way to describe it. And so that's what happens. So the period of my book here is about 100 years. It begins about 100 years before the fall of the Republic to start talking about, you know, what was it that started going wrong for the Republic, that it had persisted for 350, 400 years, and then sort of over the course of about a century, it disintegrated and collapsed in a bloody heap. So what was it that started that process? We all know the end of the story. So, like, let's talk about what the beginning
how
of the story.
How did
it begin? And as you said, you know, like, if there are any sorts of, like, interesting parallels that you want to draw, like, if we're sitting at the beginning of something, it would be nice to avoid what happened to the Romans, because it is quite a bloody heap that it winds up at.
Tell me about Rome in 146 BC, and tell me about it in its place in the world. This is when we see what the expansion.
Right. So Rome, you know, Rome begins its life as just another little city state in Italy. You know, there's plenty. It's, you know, dotting all over. They're just another little city state. And over the course of hundreds of years, they slowly begin to expand. They start to, you know, acquire territory in Italy. They're moving into northern Italy. Then they're moving into southern Italy. And this ultimately brings them into conflict with the Carthaginians, which is this, like, rival empire that's based out of North Africa. And this is where, you know, if you know a little bit about Roman history, this is the war that Hannibal is going to be figure so prominently in.
And the elephants.
Everybody knows that Hannibal, like, what do you know about Hannibal? Hannibal had elephants. How do you know that Hannibal had elephants? I don't know. I think I read it in The Far Side. Like, that's why people know about Hannibal and the elephants. But so they wind up in this sort of, like, century-long struggle with Carthage, really for control.
And Carthage is the power at the time, isn't it? In
Mediterranean? They're about equal. That's the thing. It was really a struggle between, I would say, two powers that were able to draw on about the same amount of wealth and resources and manpower. And the Romans, just over the course of about a century, got the upper hand. defeated the Carthaginians. And then where my book begins is 146 BC. And what's happened is that as a result of these Punic Wars, this long-term struggle, Rome is by far now the strongest power in the Mediterranean world.
Politically, so from sort of a bipolar power struggle to a
unipolar. And so Rome, you know, at this point, they control Spain, they control Greece, they control, you know, chunks of North Africa. They have not yet expanded to Egypt and to Syria and well into the Eastern Mediterranean, but there's nobody out there who's going to be able to stop them. So once Rome makes the decision to go over to Egypt, which is really a story of like when they run into Cleopatra, that whole story, which happens after the course of my book, there's nobody that can stop them. They're quite simply the strongest power in the Mediterranean world. And then they will hold that distinction for, you know, the next 500, 600 years.
If Samuel Huntington was around during this time, you might call it the end of history.
It was the end of history. Yes. Well, I mean, they do wind up.
Isn't that what Polybius kind of suggested that, didn't he? A historian of this period.
Well, I mean, Polybius certainly believes that there's nothing that's going to be able to stop the Romans from taking over, and that everybody better get used to the idea. I mean, he wrote a very influential history of the Roman Republic that we still use today. I mean, I drew on it heavily for the book because you can always draw on Polybius. He's a wonderful guy who writes wonderful things.
Easy read?
Not really. None of it's very easy, but I enjoy it.
I tried, but I couldn't.
I mean, it's really great. Polybius is a really subtle thinker and historian, and I like him quite a bit. But he wrote that to explain to the Greeks that, you know, our time is over and it's the Romans. It's a Roman world now, and we live in it, and we need to adjust to that.
Tell me if I'm correct in this, and I'm not a scholar on this. I'm just in preparing for this. I came across this, but he was sort of commenting on Aristotle's view of civilization and of government. And Aristotle, what would he do? Aristotle would see you had three types of government: monarchy, an aristocratic rule, and then a democratic rule.
Mm-hmm.
And a monarch, and they were cyclical. And a monarch would become would turn into despotism.
Mm-hmm.
Which then would lead to an overthrow of that and the rise of an aristocratic rule, which then would turn into an oligarchic rule. And then eventually you overthrow that with the power of the people. You get democracy, which eventually turns into chaos. And through chaos, you get the monarchy or the single ruler again. And it's a cyclical nature. And this is what I meant by Polybius. And did he see this as the end of history in the sense of Polybius said that Rome was situated to escape this dynamic.
Yeah, Polybius's theory, because he gets brought over, he's essentially a prisoner of war, is the best way to describe it, and he winds up coming back to Rome and living in Rome for a long time, but he's attached to a very powerful noble family, so he's able to investigate, you know, Roman politics, how the Romans work. And he did. He believed that the Roman constitution, right? The Romans did not have a constitution the way that we do, but describing the core functions of their government, he believed that the Roman constitution was able to break this cycle that you just described, where the monarch becomes a despot and then they're overthrown by an aristocracy that becomes an oligarchy. And that cycle, because he identified all three elements being present in the Roman constitution at the same time. So you had a popular assembly that had a democratic element that was also electing the principal leaders. And this is not like a small thing at the time. I mean, we today can, it's very easy to look back at the Republic and kind of correctly say, oh, it was just an oligarchy and, you know, the Senate called all the shots. But there was a powerful democratic element to the Republic for a long time. And then you have the aristocratic element is the Senate. And of course, they're quite powerful. And there's a balance between the democratic element and the aristocratic element. And then between those, there is the consuls and the praetors, the elected officials who are, you know, being elected, but they also then, once they are vested with power, they have this executive authority to go do the things that are necessary for the state. So he's looking at this and he's like, yeah, these are all kind of in balance and in harmony. And each one is, there's some checks and balances to it. I mean, Montesquieu reads Polybius to get to his theories and the spirit of the laws, which is going to start talking about, you know, the checks and balances and power. And that's what Hamilton and Madison are reading when they design And of course, they were reading Polybius directly, too. So he did have this theory. This Polybius was able to say this. And he said, because of this, the Republic is not going to ever collapse in that way. The ironic bit being that here comes the kicker, is that right when Polybius is writing this, is right when the aristocratic element of the state, the Senate, begins to take on more power and more authority than they previously had. And they did start to crowd out the democratic element, and they even crowded out the executive element, because the consuls were just drawn from the ranks of the Senate. So there was really no conflict ever between the consuls and the Senate, and the Senate started co-opting the democratic aspects of the system. And so by when the 140s and 130s are coming along, like when actually Polybius is writing all of this, it all makes sense in theory. But in practice, the aristocratic element has already started to expand to the point where it's going to create that democratic populist reaction that, you know, Aristotle had correctly identified as something that might happen.
Yeah. So then tell me about the situation at home in Rome that would feed this democratic or even a populist feel that's going on. What are the conditions? Again, Rome's at, it seems, at its highest point. You've defeated Carthage. You've taken over a bunch of Greek areas, and then also what, Spain too?
Yeah, Spain. They conquered the Spanish too.
Yeah. So what's happening at home then during this period?
So as a result of this military conquest, this military and political conquest, you have the wealth of the Mediterranean world is now pouring into Italy and pouring specifically into Rome. So this is wealth on an almost unimaginable scale that is pouring into Rome over the course of just a few generations. So you have this, there is this skyrocketing economic equality. If we were going to use today's terms to describe it, you would say there's skyrocketing economic inequality, because those senatorial leaders, that senatorial element that was gaining more and more power, they were the generals, they were the consuls, they were the people who were in charge of the disbursement of those funds. They were in control of the state treasury, which is where all of this stuff was being deposited. So this very small clique of senatorial families just have so much money now, and it's insane. So the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, but why are they getting poorer? It's because when they were being hauled off to fight in these same wars, they're the privates, they're the sergeants, the centurions of the Roman armies. They're getting hauled off to fight in these battles and these wars that go on for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years at a stretch, in a way that when they were just fighting at home, when they were fighting Italian campaigns in the early days of the Republic, you'd go, you'd fight for a couple months, and then like, oh, it's harvest time. Let's everybody break, right? Because everybody on both sides is living a fundamentally agrarian lifestyle. So it's like, oh God, it's harvest time for you. It's harvest time for me. Let's call a truce. We'll go back. We'll harvest our crops. And then and then we'll come back and we'll figure it out. And if we can't get it straightened away by October, we'll just, take the winter off and pick it up where we left off. Well, this stops happening. And you stop being able to come home and harvest your crops and come home and take care of your little small plot of land. So these guys are coming back from 5-6 years on campaign, and their little small farms are ruined. So they can't keep up with their richer neighbors. They don't have the resources themselves to bring their little plots of land back up to its productive level. And so they start getting bought out by all those richer families.
Rich people.
Yeah, they're like, so the rich guys are sitting there with these piles of gold. And in Roman civilization, land is the true measure of wealth, not gold coins. So they're like, well, I'll give you some of my gold and you give me your plot of land. And now we have a nice transaction. And that really leads to, over the course of decades and then about 100 years, just the complete dispossession of most of the smallhold farmers. The citizen farmer that had been the backbone of the Roman Republic is basically just going to be eradicated by this process of economic inequality. And that creates, the resentful energy that is going to fuel this, to get back to the final kicker of this, is that's going to fuel this populist reaction to what the aristocracy is doing.
I mean, you're not overstating that.
No, I don't.
The populism of this.
No.
Yeah. Mike Duncan, now we're going to go back to the Senate, and they begin, and we'll talk about Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, two very important figures in your story here. I started reading your book on, the night that the Senate our Senate, the United States Senate, took up the tax reform measure. So, you know, they're in. I had it on C-SPAN all the way up to 2 a.m. when I was reading your book. And it was kind of exciting in a way, because you have this great scene in your book that you write about over the debate of land reform bill concerning this. So it was called the Lex Agraria. And again, I couldn't help but think of the parallels as I'm reading about this debate that now is coming, being brought by Tiberius Gracchus. As I'm reading about this, here I am watching the things unfold in the U.S. Senate over the tax reform bill.
What one might call the opposite of the Lex Agraria?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, let me simplify. Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus.
Yes.
Tell me about it. They're brothers.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So Tiberius is 10 years older than Gaius, and Tiberius comes along first. And, you know, everything that I was just talking about with this, you know, with the economic inequality that is beginning to, it's beginning to become a real problem. And lots of, I mean, the Gracchi are not like lower born rabble rousers or anything. Right. Like they're inner circle Roman nobility. But a lot of these guys can see that there's, you know, this dislocation, the social and economic and political dislocation that's going on, that, you know, you got Roman citizens that are truly losing any kind of sense of dignity that they once had. It's becoming more difficult to recruit for the legions. There's a lot of problems that are brewing that could be solved if they were able to replenish the supply of citizen farmers who just own a plot of land that they work. And now you're sort of restoring, you're bringing back. It's weird. The Gracchi are considered to be very radical innovators, but right. in this one particular way, it's a very conservative thing that they're trying to do. They are trying to recreate things as they had been before things started to change. But the only way you can do it is by just going to the rich and taking their land and redistributing it to the poor. And that's what the Lex Agraria was going to do.
And this is about public land, right?
Right, sure. Yeah. Very, very specifically, there was publicly owned land. There was Ager Publicus that the Roman state owned. Nobody actually did own it, but you could lease it to an individual. But there was a law on the books that said that, to take the take the equivalent measurements was about 300 acres, that a family could not control or lease more than 300 acres of public land. But over the decades, you know, those rules had just been completely ignored, because the only people who were going to enforce the rules were themselves, like, had way more public land than they were ever supposed to own. So it's like, let's all just get away with this together. So they were all getting away with it together. And what the Lex Agraria proposed to do was to enforce those laws. And if they went through, I mean, we're talking about, like, yeah, we're going to hire land surveyors, we're going to hire clerks, we're going to hire mules and have guys go out there and go through deed records. And if you are controlling more than 300 acres of public land, then we're going to strip you of the rest. We're going to divvy it up into small plots, and we're going to give it to, you know, the dispossessed poor citizens of Rome. So this is the big project that Tiberius Gracchus is trying to introduce. And, you know, by the end of chapter one, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but spoiler alert, Tiberius Gracchus is going to wind up dead. He's going to be beaten to death in an attempt to prevent him really from moving forward with these reforms. And then his attempt to run for re-election as a tribune, which is like the big breaking point in the story of Tiberius.
Right. And they're doing everything even before he's killed.
Right.
And that's an important moment. But even before that moment, I mean, again, there's just all these procedures that are happening in the Senate that they're trying to stop a vote, trying to stop him from speaking. Again, I'm reading this as I'm watching the Senate debate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, these little things, like,
I mean, it was real.
Yeah. There's a moment where, I mean, so Tiberius knows that this is not going to be a very popular bill. And the way it had always been done is a tribune was supposed to take a bill to the Senate, have the Senate comment on it. Well, he knows the Senate's going to say, we disapprove of this. So he says, I'll just take it directly to the people. This kind of gets the Senate on edge, and they more or less hire a tribune to veto the reading of the bill so that the bill can't even be read. And if the bill can't be read, then it can't come to a vote. Right? This had never – there was nothing illegal about this, but it is certainly nothing that had ever been done before. So Tiberius retaliates, and he says, okay, well, you're going to veto my bill. Well, I'm going to veto every bill, right? Now we're just going to shut down the government, right? It's like, when we've seen, and like you say, I mean, this is not anything. I'm telling you, this is Plutarch, you know, this is Plutarch and Appian. This is not something out of the New York Times, but it could be, in the sense that this leads to literally a shutdown of the government for a little while. And then the tribune in question continues to block the vote. And so Tiberius asks the assembly, and they do it because they're all in his pocket, to depose that tribune from office. There's nothing illegal about that, but that had never been done before either. So they literally vote to remove that guy from power so that they can push forward with this vote. And yeah, I mean, there's these sorts of things when you read these things and you're just flipping through the ancient histories. And then, yeah, as you say, you go back to C-SPAN or you go back to what's going on CNN and you're like, wow, I see Mitch McConnell's not even allowing a hearing on a Supreme Court nominee. Like, these are the kinds of things that I do think that there are parallels that one. And then, you know, one of the big theories of the book before we get, you know, too far on down this is once you start breaking all of these little rules, all these things that had been done a certain way, and now you're going to ignore that.
Setting new precedents.
Yeah, ignore it. Yeah, and you're going to set precedents that can be then followed by people who come later and who will then take it even further. And there's a snowball effect to all of this where there was nothing immediately there was no immediate existential threat to the Republic, but the accumulation of this over the years and decades does roll you all the way eventually to Julius Caesar.
Tell me about the death of Tiberius Gracchus.
Well, Tiberius Gracchus was beaten to death by his enemies.
And this is after their supporters. Yeah, and, no. Opponents.
So what goes on is that he manages to pass the Lex Agrarii. They've begun the process of redistributing the land, but his term expires after 1 year. I mean, this is part of the, you know, the bedrock of Republican political principle is you serve for a single year and then you retire. And Tiberius Gracchus proposes to run for re-election. This had never been done before.
He's trying to be a king.
Yeah, he's trying. Yeah, and they will
absolutely. They're anathema towards a king.
Right, of course.
Their founding mythology.
Exactly. So, yeah, he's accused of trying to make himself a king. And in the midst of the vote to re-elect him as tribune, a gang of senators led by the Pontifex Maximus himself, like conservative aristocratic senators and their retainers or their clients, mob into the election and just start cracking skulls. And one of the skulls that they crack is Tiberius Gracchus, and that's the end of him. That stops his re-election, and then they're able to sort of, it takes a little while to play out, but they are able to ultimately dry up the land redistribution, which had, you know, ultimately started all of this.
And then they threw his body in the Tiber River. You don't want to turn him into, they didn't want him to be turned into a martyr or a place where people, like a burial site where you can, kind of that they did Osama bin Laden, right? They dumped his body in the sea so that there wouldn't be this gathering spot for people to honor him.
Yeah, and very specifically in the moment, they did not want the funeral of Tiberius Gracchus to turn into a reigniting of the conflict, right? So these guys had been sort of jumped, right? Like Tiberius and his supporters had more or less been jumped by these conservative senators. And if you throw a funeral a couple days later, like maybe they're going to organize and be like, okay, well, you punched us. We're not going to come back to you. So yeah, they just sort of unceremoniously dumped them all in the Tiber River.
And the significance of killing Tiberius, this is the first serious act of violence. Is it political violence anyways in the Republic?
No, not really. You go back to, so the Republic is founded traditionally in 509 BC. Yeah. This is where we put it. Tiberius Gracchus is going to die in 133 BC. So in those intervening hundreds of years, there were domestic conflicts. There were great battles, but there was called the conflict of the orders between the old patricians and the plebs and, you know, who's going to have rights. And this is actually where the tribunes come from. There are great showdowns. But like there's a guy who gets pushed off a cliff here and a guy who gets pushed off a cliff there. And like there's some scuffles. But I mean, when Tiberius gets attacked, when Tiberius and his supporters get attacked, that's 300 people that are dead in a single day. That's the body count of that particular moment. There is nothing like that that had ever gone on for hundreds of years. This was a truly shocking thing that happened. Whether, you know, no matter what side of the equation you were on, whether you supported Tiberius and the Lex Agrarii or whether you didn't, I mean, you look up there, that had never happened before. Yeah. I think it's important to remember that, you know, we do sort of think of the ancient world as being a violent place where you know, life was cheap, and you know, life was cheap in the ancient world. But it's not like this was just another example of like major political violence. This is the beginning of that cycle that does wind up.
It would lead to a lot more violence.
Oh yeah, yeah. So yeah, my book is very violent.
Yes,
you know,
it's definitely
got a, I don't know if it's an NC-17 rating, yeah. But certainly if you're a 13-year-old out there and you're listening to it, maybe ask mom and dad before you crack it open.
We'll see what happens how the movie comes out.
Right. There's plenty of heads on spikes by the end of it.
Yeah.
And then it you know, the end of the Republic is, you know, warlords just fighting for control of power. They're just after power.
Things like fall apart.
Yeah, the Republic is now no longer even a thing. It's just men with swords running into each other until one of them wins.
Yeah, I think about Tiberius being killed and leading to more violence and this is different. This isn't violence in the Senate yet on C-SPAN, but we'll see what happens there. And of course, we've had political violence in this country before in the 60s and 70s. But, you know, here in Berkeley, I've been to some of these Trump and Antifa rallies where there's just political violence in the street.
Yeah.
And in my lifetime, I know we've had political violence before, but never in my lifetime, really.
Yeah, well, there's a thing, too, where, like, so there's different kinds of political violence, right? There's sort of, there's top-down political violence. This has been a regular feature, not just of American society, but of all societies where, you know, you've got the police force and, you know, you go in and you crack skulls of the people who might be trying to rise up. So top-down political violence is nothing new. It goes on now. It's always gone on. And bottom-up political violence has been reoccurring. And, you know, if we're talking about the 60s, I mean, that's what the Weathermen were up to. You talk about, you know, in Northern Ireland, I mean, that's top-up political violence where you have sort of people that are out of political power who would like to acquire political power. They're going to use violence as a tool to achieve their political end. So that's something that we've seen quite a bit, and we've even seen it in the United States. But what we don't get much of is this clash of parties where you have two different basically equal groups that are competing for an election or competing for an office or trying to get a bill passed or not, who then ultimately like each have like an armed sort of quasi-militia that is working for the party where those militia groups were. So we have not really ever seen, you know, except in New York, right? When the Boss Tweeds of the world are really, you know, kind of going out with clubs like Gangs of New York style. You know, we have seen this a little bit, but certainly like in the 20th century, this has not been a very particular feature of American politics. And you do get the sense, I think we've been really lucky. I feel like since 2015, because it just kind of feels like it's maybe right on the edge of our seats. You know, when the Republican National Convention happened it was in Cleveland,
yeah.
Right? And, you know, going into that, you're like, what's about to happen? Like everything had been brewing for quite a while. Like there was going to be major protests at that Trump rally. Armed supporters of Trump were going to be coming to that rally. Like we all knew this. And like, is this going to be, you know, is this going to be like the 68 Chicago convention, but even more so? And I'm actually quite thankful that it just kind of came and went.
Yeah.
We haven't gotten there yet.
That's right.
So we have these like, you know, we have these knucklehead Trump supporters, and not to editorialize, but the Antifa Trump supporter rallies that they run into each other in a park in Portland, Oregon, and kind of punch each other.
Yeah.
I feel like they're cosplaying a little bit what's going on. I don't feel like this is real.
Marginal too.
Yeah, it's like super on the margins. These guys are not like real players, I think, in any serious sense. But it does feel like maybe we are getting to the point where if a couple of things happen that we will have more of this, where, hey, it's election day, but there's armed men roaming the ballot boxes and chasing people away.
This
is what happened in Rome, is that, hey, there's a vote. It's going on. We don't want this bill to pass, or we don't want this guy to get elected. So we will literally knock over the voting stalls and not let anybody vote. Or if he's about to win, I mean, people start winding up dead if it looks like they're going to win an election. So we haven't gotten there yet. We're not, you know, if America is anywhere, like we're not at this point where we do have that kind of political violence. And that's nice. I would prefer, I will editorialize here again, I would prefer a world with less political violence of that type, because that's a very dangerous and very sharp and very slippery.
Things can fall apart.
Very quickly.
Things fall apart, who makes sure that the Social Security checks are in the mail and that the water's clean?
Exactly.
And, you know, all the things we take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always so guaranteed. So Tiberius Gracchus is killed.
Mm-hmm.
But his reforms
mm-hmm.
live on.
Yeah, the Lex Agraria, the land redistribution, is going to be arrested quite a bit after his death. The Senate's going to figure out a couple of things that they can do to put a stop to it. They're too detailed for us to go into here, but you can read it.
But basically what they did was they gave it a lack of enforcement, lack of funding. I mean, see this today.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, one of the big things that they tried to do it, but Tiberius got around it, was they said, okay, well, you can have your commission, you can have your land commission, but we're not going to vote you any money to do it. Now Tiberius is like, you got me there. But, you know, he stole a... Well, we don't have to get into all the details. You can read about it in my book, The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. So the land redistribution process starts to peter out. But Tiberius's younger brother, Gaius, sort of picks up the baton. And he comes along a couple years later. He's now, you know, with his brother dead, he becomes the de facto head of this sort of political faction that Tiberius had helped organize. And Gaius is going to introduce, when he gets himself elected tribune a couple years later, he's going to introduce not just land redistribution, but he wants to build colonies. He wants to build roads. He wants you know, jobs for people out in the rural areas. Yeah, he wants, you know,
the debt cancellation.
There was lots of debt. I mean, debt cancellation was a routine thing. I don't think debt cancellation was one of the parts of Gaius's program. But he is going to try to address in a massive way, in sort of a coordinated way, like many of these problems that were opening up as a result of Rome's great imperial triumph and all this inequality that is getting worse and driving people off their land. You have, you know, poor people in the cities who are suffering from food scarcity. And like if one grain shipment doesn't come in, then like the whole city's going to explode in a famine, right? And he's like, well, I know how we can fix this. We'll subsidize the grain. And then, you know, that'll just be a smart thing that we do. So he's introducing all of these reforms, but it goes the same way for Gaius that it did for his brother. There's a conservative element inside the Senate that is going to resist this. They are going to they co-opt a lot of his measures. There's a tribune that comes in named Drusus the Elder, who becomes one of Gaius's fellow tribunes, and he says, you know, oh, Gaius is going to give you 4 colonies. Well, I'll give you 12 colonies. And, oh, Gaius is going to give you a plot of land, but you have to pay property tax. Well, I'm going to give you a plot of land, but you won't have to pay property tax. And, you know, Gaius wants to give it not just to Roman citizens, but to Italians as well, like non-citizens, like just people in Italy. He wants to redistribute it to everybody. Well, I'll only give it to true Roman citizens. And this peels off a lot of support from Gaius. Mm. But Drusus never had any interest in following through with any of this. This was just a huge dust cloud that he was throwing up to be like, you know, they wanted to stop Gaius's reform. So how do you do it? You actually promise even greater reforms. And then once the people have turned to you and are like, all right, well, you say you're going to do even more for me. Well, I'll follow you. That allows the Senate to push Gaius to one side. He too, you know, will die a violent death. And then once Gaius is out of the picture, you know, where did those 12 colonies go? Where did the tax-free land go? Where did all of these promises wind up?
It was gone.
They're gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were never followed through on. Because the point was not to solve problems. The point was to peel away support from Gaius long enough that they could dispose of him.
Looking at Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, or Gracchi, I guess if you say it together.
Just Gracchi.
Yes.
Gracchi,
I'm sorry. Yeah. Are they revolutionaries? You said on one hand earlier that there's even a conservative element to them of trying to get it the way things were before. But before this time, a serious student of history, have seen anything like this before that you saw with Tiberius and Gaius?
The answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
There were definitely examples of this type of program, the populist demagogue was a fairly standard archetype in the ancient world, mostly in Greece, right? So, and you know, all the educated Romans at this point are, you know, they all read and speak Greek, right? And they've studied Greek history. And there was actually one of the books that I was reading about Tiberius Gracchus proposed that just before the arrival of the Gracchi, that this treatise had been published about some of these Greek demagogues who had, you know, who'd done X, Y, and Z, and they promised land reform, and they wound up killing a bunch of people. Like, there's like real serious demagogues. I'm gonna rise up the people, and then we're gonna go murder the aristocracy of this city. And that idea was actually floating around inside the Senate. And then they were like watching Tiberius like try to do this same thing, and they're like, oh my God, he is gonna come murder us in our beds, even though I don't think that that's what Tiberius was up to. So there were examples of this kind of populist demagoguery that existed. But whether the Gracchi are revolutionaries, they're not trying to overthrow the government.
These are serious reformers.
They're very serious. They're reformers.
Yeah.
But they, both Tiberius and Gaius, and the other thing that's important to note is that they were tribunes, right, when this is happening.
That's right.
They're 30 years old. They're 32 years old. A tribunate is not the end goal of any Roman politician's career, right? You want to be consul. Consul's like the real prize. That's where you get when you're 40, 45 years old. So a lot of what Tiberius and Gaius were up to was a step along the way, on the way to their consulship, the consulship that they're ultimately going to be pursuing. They're growing their power base. They're using all these popular programs to make themselves more popular and more influential so that they could eventually run for consul. But they die as tribunes. So we think of them as if that was really, this was the end game for them, but it was not.
Right.
But I also don't believe that the end game was overthrowing the Senate and making themselves a tyrant. I don't believe that about Tiberius, and I don't believe it about Gaius. I believe that they wanted to be the most powerful and influential men in Rome. And I believe that they were willing to increase the power of other groups at the expense of the Senate, but not that they wanted to crash the system down on its head.
We are in conversation with Mike Duncan. Mike Duncan is a renowned history podcaster. He hosted the award-winning podcast, History of Rome. He is now producing another podcast, also very popular, called Revolutions, which is about major revolutions in world history. He is author of the book that we are in conversation about. It's called The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. This conflict obviously would live beyond the deaths of both Tiberius and Gaius.
Yep.
Tell me what would happen. How do we get from this to Julius Caesar? Julius Caesar is the end of the Republic.
Right. He's the end of the Roman Republic. And we're still at the beginning of the end of the Roman Republic. So those are the two bookends. I mean the Gracchi brothers and then Caesar, and really like Octavian and Antony, you know, depending on where you want to put the pin in the like Schrodinger's cat box that is the Civil War. Like, when does the Republic die? Like, is it dead now? Like, this is a debate that you can have about like when it actually died. Is the cat alive or dead? Don't know. But what happens to the Gracchi, their example and the memory of them continues to live on in the Republic. And the way that they harnessed powers outside of the elite conservative aristocracy, the powers that they were able to harness, people did see that and were able to try to emulate what it is that the Gracchi did and try to carry forward the legacy of the Gracchi, even if they themselves were dead. So there's about, Gaius dies at the end of the 120s. So the 110s, right, on your way on down. So it's hard to do like shorthand, like the 110s BC. Like, what is that?
Okay,
so it's the 110s BC. That's a conservative decade or so in Rome. I think that the Gracchan Populare coalition had been pretty well smashed, but it does come back. It does re-rise. They sort of put it off for 10 years, but it does sort of come back. Specifically, you know, if you get into the book, the corruption that is introduced by Jugurtha. Jugurtha is this North African king who wants to have his own way. He wants to sort of flout Roman authority. This is kind of offensive to the Roman people, but for some reason the Roman Senate isn't doing anything about it. Why isn't the Roman Senate doing anything about Jugurtha? And it's because Jugurtha is paying massive bribes to the Roman Senate to not get in his way, to not get into his business. So there's more or less a corruption scandal. I mean, a foreign power has more or less corrupted the Roman Senate, and this leads to a renewal of that populare energy I think it's taken over by a new generation of figures, and this then becomes sort of a cycle that does go on then for the next 100 years, where even if you get to a point where the conservatives have once again like emerged victorious, which happens again like after about 100 BC, there's another little 10-year period where the energy of the populari had sort of spent itself in a pretty major battle inside of Rome. That I think is in chapter 8 of The Storm Before the Storm, the beginning of the end of the Roman Republic, which mm-hmm. you should all buy and read, and then this will all make sense to you. But this just kind of keeps coming back around. And Julius Caesar is himself uses this. You can back up and look at what Gaius Gracchus was doing and Tiberius Gracchus was doing, and then fast forward to what Julius Caesar is doing.
Is he using their playbook?
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly he's using it, through Marius. And through some other people, because, I mean...
Marius was his uncle.
Of course, Marius is literally Julius Caesar's uncle, and Marius is one of these people who uses this kind of populari tactics. So there's kind of a direct line that gets passed down, and Julius Caesar's a populari leader, and he's going to use that, and he's going to be the one who ultimately does succeed in... And by Caesar's time, like, he's the same thing. Is he trying to overthrow the Senate? That was never really... what he was trying to do. He wanted, not unlike the Gracchi, to be the most powerful man in Rome, the most influential man in Rome. But was he trying to destroy the Republic? Like, I don't think he was. Certainly that wasn't his aim to begin with. It just is what happened as a result of his pursuit, his insanely ambitious pursuit of power, his relentless pursuit of power. Does wind up destroying the Republic, but I don't think that's...
So was it Caesar? It wasn't Augustus Caesar?
So Julius Caesar...
Who came after.
Yeah. He's Caesar's great nephew. So Julius Caesar introduces the death of the Republic. And then it's Octavian who then becomes Augustus. That guy is the one who puts the stamp on it, and it's dead and buried by that point. But like I say, this is like a... between about 49 BC and 27 BC, you can sit down and make a case for about... five or six different moments when you're like, and that's when the Republic died. Was it when Caesar crossed the Rubicon? Was it when he was assassinated? Was it when Antony Octavian won the Battle of Philippi? Is it when, when Octavian defeated Antony? Where is the actual line getting drawn?
Looking at even ancient Greece and looking at the philosophers during this period and the historians, a lot of people were never enthusiastic about democracy, right? I mean, it was seen as being chaotic, as inefficient, not working. And then here we have the situation that we're talking about, Rome, leading to the end of the Republic. And we get back to that cycle, Aristotle's cycle, right? You get into this chaos. When people are in chaos, you look at Syria today, right? Had this civil war. Eventually, what people want when their world is destroyed and there's... we take normalcy for granted. We take stability for granted. But when it's gone, it's probably what people want the most after that. Is that what happened in Rome? Yeah, this 100 years, more than 100 years of what seems to be political chaos. And eventually, people just want stability. I mean, of course, many people have come and gone during that period.
Right. And I would say that's entirely accurate. And specifically, I mean, we have 100 years of upheaval. But, by the time that Augustus is finally ending things, let's say this is in 27 BC, you're talking about just 20 years of nonstop civil war. Like that generation, and I actually talk about there's a long digression that I go into in the History of Rome podcast where I talk about this particular generation that was born around 60 or 70 BC, who were just put on this earth to know nothing but destruction and famine and internecine strife and, brothers killing brothers just because they happen to be assigned to different legions and the destruction of everything, the depopulation of Italy is like a huge part of this. Yeah. And it's insane that the Roman civilization sort of kept going. It's an amazing conversation in its own right that Roman civilization managed to survive this nonstop struggles. But yeah, I mean, when Augustus finally wins and Antony has been defeated and he's like, all right, it's all over. I murdered all my enemies. People were like, okay, can we stop now? Like, let's stop with all the stuff and you do whatever it is that you want to do. And that sounds great. And one of the other things is that Through this whole period, all of these sort of grievances that people had, all of this resentment that they had, all of these needs that they that needed to be addressed, that somebody like Gaius Gracchus is actually trying to address in the 120s, had still never really been taken care of. The Senate had consistently failed to address all of these issues. That by the time Augustus comes along, Augustus is saying, I will do it all, but I'm going to do it more or less. I mean, he plays a game about the Republic still existing, but it's like, I'm going to do it by executive fiat. People are like, great, go for it. Like, we don't mourn the death of the Republic. Like, we don't care about those guys. If the Senate doesn't really have power anymore, what's it to me? I don't care about those guys. They never addressed any of my issues anyway. Now, what's interesting is that the fall of the aristocratic element of Rome, which is the Senate, which was in a major way driven by this popular democratic, you know, energy, as predicted by Aristotle's theory, then they overthrow. It does lead to chaos and anarchy, and then you have the strong man come back around, and you could say that, you know, as a model of enlightened despotism, Augustus does a pretty good job, yeah. You know, in the sense of he ruled well. He ruled by this point. I mean, his enemies are dead, so he doesn't have to worry about it too much. But he sort of rules on behalf of everyone, including just mere provincials. You know, he does have kind of an enlightened view of things. And he's in charge also. This is a big part of it, is that he's in charge for decades, right? So he's able to cement a lot of these reforms that were well in need of being done. So he's this enlightened monarch. Well, Aristotle's theory predicts that it devolves into mere tyranny and that there's an aristocratic response. Well, you go out from Augustus a couple years, who are you running into? Caligula, who is just, you know, one of, God, I forget exactly what it is, a great grandnephew of Augustus.
Yeah.
Nero is going to come along. I mean, it slides into that, you know, that tyranny, that despotism that sort of demands an aristocratic response, which never comes.
Never comes.
Never comes. So for the next 500 years, Rome will remain an autocracy. And when the Julio-Claudian dynasty is overthrown, when Nero is overthrown and new emperors come into play, it's new emperors, and it continues to be an autocracy. So the triumph of the monarchical element of the Polybian constitution or the Aristotelian constitution, well, they just persist then forever. And there never is an aristocratic overthrow of the despot, not, as opposed to just the individual, but the system of despotism never gets overthrown, and it continues to persist for the next
so that was
centuries.
Incredibly stable.
Yeah, and it turned out to be an incredibly stable form of government.
Yeah.
So it's like one of those things, you're like, this is why history is fun. This is why it's fun to get into this stuff.
Yeah, why democracy, it's the norm in today's world,
mm-hmm.
but historically not so.
No, and I mean, the idea that democracy is a good thing is certainly not an idea that was ever shared by, you know, I mean, because like literacy, just like education and literacy is as a mass phenomenon is also a pretty recent development. And so if you go back through who would be considered the educated classes, which is like, you know, the wealthier sons and daughters of any given country, with most of the citizens being illiterate or uneducated beyond, you know, basic math, and I can scratch my name. So those guys, nobody ever likes democracy. They only ever describe it as mob rule,
right?
Which is like, oh, if you put the mob in charge, I mean, God, that's literally the worst thing you could ever possibly do. And I'm in the middle of, you know, in Revolutions, the podcast I do now, I'm in the middle of 1848, and this is one of the huge huge battles.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, I'm in the middle of the revolutions of 1848, which is these battles between educated liberals who are like, oh, you know, we want political rights, but we don't want to give everybody the vote. That would be insane. We can't do that. So it is a new phenomenon. And, you know, democracy has never had a very good reputation in history, but I'm for it.
Yeah.
I think it's actually worked fairly well. And when I look at, you know, that there's always proposals out there. You'll find them even today in the United States that are like, well, you know what the big problem is? Voters are idiots, and they need to be able to pass a test to, you know, be able to have the right to vote, and they need to be able to do X, Y, and Z. And it's like, you know, that's I think that's going to cause way more troubles than it would actually solve, because, like, you know, who's writing that test? Who's administering that test? How are you going to tell who can rule well and who can't.
Down to our really our final minute here, and your podcast are very apolitical. At least you don't inject a lot of current politics into
it. No, I keep it
all really
on the show.
Going into the history. But how worried are you about our republic right now? With this knowledge that you have, study that you've done.
I'm famously very worried. It's hard for me because I wrote this book. I pitched this book out 2.5 years ago. That there's this period in Roman history.
So you're writing this before.
Yeah. I've started working on this, and this is an idea that I've had for 5, 6, 7 years. Really, since I hit this period when I was doing the History of Rome podcast, I set it aside. I was like, man, I should probably come back to this 50-year period. This is really interesting, and there is some parallels. Yeah. I'm writing this book about the collapse of the Roman Republic while I'm watching the 2016 election unfold. I'm also producing this show, Revolutions, which what I do every, I'm on my 7th season of this, but every season begins with me, teasing out what are the big themes, what are the threads that start to, what was going on in Ancien Régime France before in the 1750s and 1760s that is going to lead to the revolution in 1789 or 1786, which is when I think the revolution began, but not to get off on that. What are the threads that are going to come together that are going to cause the revolution? So this is the way my brain is operating. And then, you watch the 2016 election, you watch American politics, and it's very difficult for somebody like me to not then look at this and be like, well, I could very easily explain the origins of the Second Civil War. If one were to break out in 10 years, that wouldn't be too terribly difficult for me to do. I think we'd already be 5 episodes into a revolution series on, the beginning of the second American Civil War, the second American Revolution. So I think that I personally believe that that complacency is the worst possible reaction to this, or even for somebody who has historical perspective, right? One of the things that people will say is, it's been bad before and it's worked out all right. So don't worry about it. Take the long view, it's going to be okay. And it's like, well, there are times when it got really, really bad for let's say an entire generation or something that was good is lost. And sort of humanity keeps going or civilization keeps going, but you did wind up losing something that was good and important. So I think that there's plenty to be worried about out there, and that if we might be being called upon as a generation to be more engaged politically, more engaged citizens, and start demanding better of the ruling class, for however you want to describe them, I think that's definitely something that needs to go on, or we're screwed. So on that very very cheery note, I always end these things on such a cheery note.
Well, it's a cheery topic.
Yeah.
Mike Duncan, I have enjoyed our conversation, though, and I do thank you greatly.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Again, Mike Duncan is the author of the book, The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. You can also check out his podcast, and each of these have a lot of episodes to them, so you can spend a good amount of time going through these. The History of Rome, and also the one he's currently still working on, Revolutions.